Hello and welcome to Impactability, the Nonprofit Leaders Podcast. This is a show that explores the landscape of the nonprofit organization, big and small, offers some incredibly helpful information and resources, and gives nonprofits a place to share ideas and get advice. I'm your host, Josh Hirsch. Our show is sponsored by Sukup Strategic Solutions, offering a wide variety of services to help nonprofits maximize their impact. So let's get into solving the problems that might be plaguing your nonprofit. Thanks for joining us again on Impactability, the Nonprofit Leaders Podcast. Today, we're joined by Dan Blakemore. Dan is the Vice President of Philanthropy at the Conservancy for Cuyahoga Valley National Park. Throughout his more than 15 years in the nonprofit fundraising, he has worked in museums, the performing arts, and higher education. Dan is an active member of the Association of Fundraising Professionals, where he serves as the U.S. Political Action Committee Vice Chair and a member of the Government Relations Committee. He is a board member and past president of AFP's Northeast Ohio chapter. Dan serves his community as a diversity on board coach with Leadership Akron and as a trustee of the African American Archives Auxiliary at Western Reserve Historical Society. That's a mouthful. And on the board of Cuyahoga Arts and Culture and the National Park Friends Alliance. He's a proud graduate of both Howard University and New York University's Robert F. Wagner Graduate School of Public Service. Dan lives in Northeast Ohio with his wife and three young kids. Dan, thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure to be with you, my friend.
And Dan, before we jumped on this call, we were having some talks about today's topic, which is about leadership. And I'm curious to hear from you, what defines, in your mind, a good leader?
Oh, my. Someone, particularly in the nonprofit space, someone living the mission, someone who encourages, who doesn't drag staff along, but brings them along, even if they, whether they agree or not on the long-term strategy. Yeah, that's probably the first thing that come to mind, at least.
Okay, so you say not dragging them along. You want to set an example and lead by example. You want them to see within you those leadership qualities that makes them come to work every day excited to be part of a team. What are those qualities that a good leader needs?
Really good in relationship management, takes direction when necessary, strategic thinker, inclusive, open to new ideas. Pause there, at least.
And I can imagine that someone who is a well-established leader, whether they've been in their field for 5 years, 15 years, 25 years or more, it can be hard to change. It can be hard to adopt and adapt to the new way of doing things. Like, clearly, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, the way that we communicate with our donors is not how we communicate nowadays. So how, as a leader, do we need to adapt our own philosophy and management to resonate with, you've got a 22-year-old baby coming out of college that's like all hyped up and going to change the world for the Cuyahoga Valley National Park. How do you listen and make sure you are inclusive of what they're bringing to the table, while at the same time you're like, listen, I know what I'm doing, but as a leader, I want you to come on board the train.
I think it's really been, for me, it really has always been about being the leader I needed when I first started in fundraising. I think it's been, 16 and a half years in this exciting field thus far. And it's, I feel like probably almost the first 10, most of my leaders, if they were fundraisers, their experience wasn't exactly in where they found themselves at the time, or they totally fell into fundraising after a successful career doing something totally different and had honed their chops a bit, but were not classically trained fundraisers as we may think of them for those of us who've been in the field for a while. You have to continue being committed to learning. I think You and I go way back to the early days of AFP and the AF peeps that are still in existence, but not certainly not in the original form. Thinking back to what, 2011, 2012 in Vancouver, things we were doing around social media then when the association was just desperate to engage with people online is so worlds away from what they are doing now. That commitment to learning is so important because it's, if you can learn, okay, yes, we have all had to embrace all things virtual because for a year or two or three, we were literally unable to be in front of those donors in person in the ways we normally would have. I started here in the park the first week of January of 20. So when we got sent home on the, oh, this virus is out here, we'll be back in 2 weeks. Oh, pack up your desk. And I was like, I've been here 2 months. I've got 2 notepads, 3 pencils and a pen, and a very long list of donors I had not yet met. Oh, but oh, in 2 weeks we'll be back and you can see everybody again. And okay, in July, when it was, maybe we'll start letting 3 people at a time back in the office. Okay, how am I going to start getting in front of people as the director of philanthropy? It's okay, it's Zoom for a national park. It's okay, we'll go for a hike outside with a little distance, probably with our masks still on. Those are all things. No, in 2019 fundraising where I was before, there was no all life to social distance. It was a museum and a historic house museum and a botanical garden. It was all about the place. So if they can't be there or we have to be distanced from each other, how in the hell am I going to raise money that way? But we had no choice. As I like to say to my team, revenue goals never decrease, even in a pandemic. So make a way because the dollars need to come in. And really for us, because the Conservancy is structured the way it is and we have diverse revenue streams, but the pandemic dried up our special event business. It dried up our environmental education because kids weren't in school to come on a bus to come to the education center. Oh, as my CEO was saying at the time, philanthropy gets to lead the way. And everyone's like, hey, philanthropy, how much money are you raising today? It's only 8 o'clock. Let's see who I'm talking to. Look, we still have to get the grants out. We still have to engage with board members, even if it's all on Zoom. Get them motivated to still bring some friends to a socially distanced event that we held, particularly in the real heat of the pandemic. But that learning, because you have to be open to new things. You have to understand that the stewardship I was doing when I started in 2007, the core of it is still there, but it has changed because I'm at a totally different organization. I'm no longer in New York City, but also so much more, we can do so much more virtually with video. We were not recording anything for anybody when I started at a community music school on the Lower East Side of Manhattan in 2007. It was, if you can't come to the performance, you're just out of luck. Hopefully you can come to the next. But now it's, oh, now every concert, I'm still a member. I still give there. I can see the concerts on YouTube. I'm like, oh, no, it's not the same experience of being in the auditorium, but I can still see kids learning and performing and doing well in whatever their area of study may be. So no, if you're not learning, you're getting left behind, particularly in this field.
And we have to stay on top of the pulse. We have to constantly be connected, whether that's being an active member in the Association of Fundraising Professionals, getting involved on your local or state or even at the international level. But it's also, how are we? And you made a great point. You're in this pandemic. We're living in this Brady Bunch world, but you still had millions of dollars you needed to raise. You still needed to motivate your team to show up to work every day, even though they're in basketball shorts and a t-shirt. And you being two months on the job, like you were the new guy, but they needed to respect you as a leader and you needed to rally your team. So what were some things that you did from a motivational standpoint that are applicable 3 years ago at the beginning of the pandemic, but that are still in place today?
I think our team was not meeting as often. So now we've been doing it forever, it seems like now, but every 2 weeks we are all together around whether a real table or a virtual table. The first half is always, okay, what are the top 10 projects we're all working on? How are we moving them forward? Are there things, I need marketing for this thing, and they aren't in the loop? Or, oh God, can someone get somebody from the Ed Center? We just need to know if they have two quotes from kids that were there in the last 6 months that we can add to a grant proposal. That kind of stuff has helped just keep everything moving, but also make being intentional as the pandemic ebbed, or hopefully has gone mostly away, ensuring that there are opportunities that we're together and it's not just about business, to ensure that there are some opportunities just to be together socially, ensuring that we really do have opportunities to know each other, but also because our team was so new. My vice president, I started in January. She started the prior September, so she would have 3 months of overlap with the outgoing chief development officer. And he is, before he had been our CDO for 10 years, he had been superintendent of the national park for 20 years. So he is still very well respected. He is just down the street. He actually pitched in for me when we hosted a conference here in October, and I had to be in a board meeting. We did tours at the top and the end of the conference. So I had to miss the morning session of one of the tours, talking really about the impact of philanthropy has had on our park in the last 50 years. But I tagged him in because it was, oh, he knows where all the bodies are buried. His stories are probably even better than mine because he lived some of them. But yeah, having someone like that to call upon, but between me and my vice president still being new, the longest tenured people, the grant writer, actually, I didn't know I was bringing her from my last job, but came with me from my last job. So yeah, most of us were pretty green, particularly green as a team when the pandemic hit. But yeah, looking for those opportunities to engage. And I think the culture of this organization, as one that is very welcoming, one that is very inclusive, the opportunities that kind of the organization had in place to keep us all connected really helped not just keep us together as a team, but keep us together across the organization. So whether that was, I mean, at one point we were doing what we called conservancy cribs, where people were doing Zoom tours of their apartments or houses, because it's just another, okay, I don't know when I will see you in person again, but I get to see where the hell your cat is. And oh, you have a little kid too? Great. How are you keeping sane and not just telling this person to go outside all day, every day, because we all are trying to get things done. Yes, and doing the best you can, I think, particularly in the heat of the pandemic, to stay connected and let people understand that I'm a real person and I've got this 6-month-old kid and I don't really know what the hell I'm doing, but the donors are being particularly generous because they can't go anywhere. So all their wild, exciting trips they had planned for the next year, they all got refunded. And so they've got even more cash and are saying, what is happening in the park? Or the special events we had in 20 and early 21 were really more in response to donors saying, I will give you money. I got to get out of my house. He said, I mean, because we have three longstanding fundraising events that are all about being in person, being in an exciting part of the park. But they're like, yeah. And we're like, oh, we can't do what we normally did. And they're like, yeah, that's fine. I will give you money, but I need to get out of my house. Okay, so then the first one was, okay, we're going to do prepackaged picnic lunches for people. We will put them in their trunks. Everyone will be masked. You stop, you get your food, you go. And it was like, oh, some people pulled off into the far end of the parking lot. I'm like, I want to talk. What's going on? But distance, but I got to talk to somebody that's not my wife. Yeah. Okay, how are you? The things you didn't expect you were going to be doing. And I think it's a big credit to our donors, but really donors across the country and the world, because people were given, the government was funding, was throwing money at people, which helped. And there we had a handful of people that are like, I don't need the stimulus money. Here, you use it. We know you all can, we know you all do good programs. We know you're trying to keep everything open. You all can use this more than us. So I was like, oh, I will. Again, I wasn't expecting this, but it's also, okay, flag those people for planned giving, because when someone says, I don't need the money, here, you take it. Take notes, friends. That does not happen very often. And when it does, you need... I called them, and they got notes, they got all the love things I could do from afar. But yeah, you also need to say, if they're that committed, we need to be talking more often and not just about your annual membership.
So what you were doing is you were listening, which is one of the number one traits that all fundraisers need to have, is know when to be quiet, sit on their hands, and listen to what your donor or potential donor is telling you. And at that point, how to rally your team together, how to motivate your team behind this desire by a donor. You had no intentions of doing a drive-by picnic event, but you realized the situation you were in. You heard the needs of your community. You were lucky enough to have a generous donor that said, here's my intentions. I want to support my love for your organization. And you were able to motivate and guide your team to effectively do this. These ways to remain flexible, to embrace those opportunities, don't always come along. And it takes a strong key leader to be able to drive their team to be successful in this action.
Absolutely. I think the partnership I continue to have with my boss, she was my vice president, now I'm vice president, and she's director of leadership giving. To be able to say, okay, this is what we're hearing. Can we do something? Because, yeah, it was that picnic event was not on anyone's agenda. We just said, oh, we can't do our normal fundraising events. Okay, we'll figure out how to raise those dollars in another way, but we don't really know what that is. And I said, oh, after enough people said, give me a reason to give you some money, we, of course, came up with a reason.
Early in your career, and you mentioned before you had mentors and people that you looked up to, what is it in them that made you aspire to want to be a leader, to be able to guide your team to greatness? Is it a quality that they possessed? Is it the way that they communicated with you? How can we, and whether you're that 22-year-old fundraiser out of college ready to challenge the world, or even someone who's like you and I have been in this field for 15, 20 years, we're always learning, we're always growing, we're always aspiring and following what others' leaders say. So how do we know what to find in another leader to help ourselves grow as a leader?
For me, it comes back to living the mission, which is really about, the leader I had when I was still in New York at International House, the president that hired me, Don Cuneo, he was the first alumni of International House to be president. And you could question many things of Don. You could not question his commitment. He had been on the main, he lived there in the 60s. He worked there. He had, at his death, he had a 50-year relationship with International House. From being on the board, being on staff, leading the institution, being a former president, you could not question his commitment to the organization. You could question his particular strategy on why he wants to develop these kind of programs this way, or why he thinks our fundraising should appeal in this specific way versus this. Those are the people I feel like I've learned the most from. And not even just the leaders, but even the donors that have been exceptionally generous to us. When I was at International Health, Paul Volcker was our board chair. And I actually, one of the feathers in my cap for my almost 7 years there, we started a program and scholarship endowed fund in his name in recognition of his years of service as chairman of the board. And he said, you can do this, but I'm not going to help you. I'm not going to give you any names. You go do it. And I said, okay, I'm not used to that, but let's see what happens. I was deep in the Google archives I unearthed a guy who was his special assistant in his first job at the Federal Reserve, who ends up being a multimillionaire and made a five-figure gift to this fund on the fact that it was in honor of him, not because he knew he had a great deep passion for intercultural communication and understanding amongst international and domestic graduate students in New York City. And then when finally we think we got it to about $175,000, when we came back and updated Mr. Volcker, and he said, oh, you've done pretty well for yourselves. Okay. And then the next day, a $25,000 check for him comes and is, I wanted to get to 200 here. And he went, oh, we weren't planning to solicit you for something that's honoring you. What are you doing? It's got my name on it. I want it to be at $200,000. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Volker. Those people who are selfless, Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis, who are amazing philanthropists, Mrs. Davis, now both are now deceased. But when I met Catherine, she was in her early hundreds. She and her husband had met at International House. They got married the day they graduated with their PhDs from Columbia in the 30s. He ended up being an ambassador to Switzerland under Nixon or Ford. He started a very successful money management company. They were exceptionally generous to International House in myriad ways. Her commitment really to that community and what the core of that intercultural understanding that was at the heart of that mission. And just at any time, she came up with new ways, new programs for us to implement, not just among ourselves, but really across the International Houses all over the world. The Davis Projects for Peace, she started providing these grants to students who live in each of the houses to do these $10,000 projects wherever they see fit that is really about building peace, building understanding wherever those people are. Those are experiences that those students would never have if the Davises had not met in the 30s, gotten married, and remained passionate about that organization and that place. So that selflessness is something that has certainly stuck with me. The commitment, wanting to continue to see an organization do well in the long term. Those are all things that I've tried to take with me through my fundraising career thus far.
And here you are, almost 20 years later, having raised millions of dollars, having impacted tens of, if not hundreds of thousands of lives through the various organizations you worked with, and have been able to start to think about the next phase, which is going to be our topic after the break, which is succession planning. So we're going to take a quick break, but when we do come back, Dan is going to talk to us about his philosophy on succession planning and how you need to identify within your own organization those future leaders that can take over. We'll be right back. One of the biggest challenges facing nonprofits today is securing grants. Where do I find information on grants? How do I write a grant? How do I submit the grant? And of course, the dreaded midnight deadlines. Hi, I'm Josh Hirsch, and I've been there and done that. At Sucrup Strategic Solutions, we have a team of expert grant writers with years of experience writing hundreds of grants for nonprofits just like yours. Visit our website today at sucrupstrategicsolutions.com and schedule a free consultation about your grant writing needs. That's S-O-U-K-U-P strategicsolutions.com. Let's work together and get the grant that your nonprofit deserves. Welcome back to Impactability, the Nonprofit Leaders Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Hirsch, and today I'm here with Dan Blakemore talking about how you can build a high-performing team and a guide for today's leaders. Coming up in a few minutes on our next segment of Coach's Corner, we got a great topic for you. It's going to be, how can we effectively measure the social impact of our nonprofit's work? It's a topic that I think is going to resonate with a lot of people, so make sure you stay tuned for that. But Dan, before we left on break, we started to talk about succession planning and how we can plan for the future. Within your own organization, you were a byproduct of succession planning. You're started in one role and you've now moved further along in your career within the organization and still have maintained a great relationship with your predecessor. How do you identify that, A, within yourself as time, that big R word, retirement, or you're looking to move on to a new organization? How can we ensure that the strength of what you built and have honed with your team is going to continue after you leave?
Big question. I think being intentional about understanding the team you have, where are they in their own life cycle? Are there people that are comfortable in the position they're in and are not looking to advance? Are there people who are open to new opportunities? Are there people that are looking for specific to grow in certain areas? Or are there people that you think with enough training, with enough learning, with enough experience, hopefully with you in the trenches currently, that could be well positioned to take your place or at least be contenders for that, because I feel like I have, there's a team, it's a team of seven now, including myself here, doing philanthropy at the Conservancy. My former vice president, as I said, and is closer to retirement than anything else, but mercifully wants to continue in being engaged with us and being engaged in fundraising. I know there's still going to be at least another big campaign that I am confident she will be leading just to success. But others on our team that have been here anywhere from 2 to almost 10 years, some that I know, one colleague that I particularly think of that has a great deal of potential for long-term growth in fundraising overall, and trying to find ways to provide exposure to, because she didn't come out of fundraising, but really, are there ways, how can we be intentional about exposing her to, okay, some of my work managing corporate partnerships, some of my work with our Planned Giving Society, being intentional about looking at where our biggest major donors when it comes to their cumulative giving to us, because we have a lifetime giving society, but I'd like to make some changes to how that operates and some real actual levels, so that there are opportunities to, it's not just a one-time recognition. It's, your entry point is $100,000, but okay, there's a $500,000 level and you get recognized in a different and more notable way when you get to that point. You're near the $1 million point. Okay, what do you get there? How can we show our appreciation in a way that is different from what we have done for you at $500,000 and $100,000. How can you be intentional with those people? And I think drawing upon my experience really in probably the first 10 years of my career, being in organizations where my first job, I was there for just under 2.5 years, and everyone was, how could you leave? What are you doing? I said, it's a very small team. The director's 10 years older than me and just started having kids. She's not leaving. There's literally nowhere else for me to go. You all gave me a title change that was greatly appreciated. It didn't come with any money. Like, how am I supposed to grow in my career if I want to stay in one organization my whole life where there's no advancement opportunity? So for me, it's always been, comes back to that, I try to be the manager and the leader that I know I needed in those early years in my career. So it's being fully transparent and say, I know everyone, I have no expectation that everyone's going to be on this team forever, because that's just foolish. So how can we ensure that having open dialogues, and not just when it's performance review time, but as we're looking every year, what are your goals? Where do you want to develop? And thinking strategically about the goals there that we're setting together for them each year. Are there areas that we can be stretching you? Are there things that will prepare you for whatever is next when you leave the national park? Because everyone is not going to be here for 15 years. And it's logical and sensible to understand that, but also how really seeing it as a two-way street. How can we be getting the best out of you when you're working here? But also, how can we be helping you prepare for what may be next? And if there are those that are, if this is where they want to be for another 15 years, I'm happy to have you, but I'm going to be pushing you to say, are there ways you can be developing in your current role? Thinking about, even if you're not looking to advance, particularly on the compensation side, on title, and like, if making you a senior manager help retain you, great. A bonus every 2 years help? Probably yes. Try to figure out what are those levers you could be pulling, because you need to be playing a retention game, but you also need to be investing in people, because those people will be, when they leave, will be some of your best ambassadors. To say, I was on that Dan Blakemore's team, and I was only there for 3 years, but he really made sure that they invested in me and what I was trying to do. And now I'm a senior gift officer at the Boys and Girls Club, and the things I learned there, I've been able to implement here in my new organization, in my new role. And I'm grateful for them for investing that time in me. Because there's always people that are going to boomerang. I have someone on my team who went to, I think, what is it, the Science Center, and then came back and is a master at trying to get taming Black Bod and Razor's Edge. So I give him whatever he needs, he gets it. Because I've been in Razor's Edge my entire career, but he outpaced me long before I got here. So I pay due deference to people who have that expertise. But no, it's about being intentional. It's about being thoughtful, being smart. We all know what has made us leave jobs, made us leave organizations. A lot of it can be as much about learning what you should do as also learning what the hell not to do in organizations that you said, this was great, but I gotta go. Yeah, you have to be smart. You have to be thoughtful.
And what you said there is great. So oftentimes when we think succession planning, we think of within our own organization. But when you can identify talent and realize that there are greater potentials for them outside of where their growth path is within your organization, you need to help guide them, help provide them with those opportunities to grow, get those skills, and then lesson release and say, listen, we want you here. We know there's more for you. And being able to still maintain those relationships, even when those employees have gone on somewhere else, because the situation wasn't right, because they wanted more, or just at the time it was time for a change.
Yeah.
I always feel that if I can take something from a supervisor, whether that was direct supervisor or senior staff or even C-suite level, and embody that in how I conduct myself on a daily basis, both in my office, which right now is my little Brady Bunch world because I work from home and have never met any of my coworkers and will only meet them like annually at our staff retreat.
Okay.
But we can still maintain a very successful organization. I can still be a very competent leader, and I can still help guide others within our organization, just like as you have done, identifying those talented staff along within your career. It takes a talent within yourself to be able to identify that. And I think a good leader who has a strong team knows who they need on their team, and at the same time, what are those holes that need to be filled? And sometimes you realize that you don't have the right staff capacity to make that happen. Sometimes you have to go look somewhere else. Sometimes it's taking your grants manager and saying, listen, you'd be really great at planned giving. Let's move you a completely different world. Learning new skills only adds to your brand equity as an individual and as a staff member. Dan, this has been an incredible conversation. I've thoroughly enjoyed the time we spent together. Before we wrap up, is there any last little tidbits of wisdom that you would like to leave our listeners today?
I know I'm not just talking to fundraisers. I would just say the nonprofit sector is an amazing one. I would certainly encourage, I'm biased as a fundraiser, so I would say everyone should consider doing at least one tour of duty in fundraising, because it will, if nothing else, it will broaden your perspective on the organization. You will better understand how to communicate what your organization does, because you've had to sell it to donors and funders to get them excited about the work you are doing. But also look for ways to, if you are not in fundraising, look for ways to partner with your fundraising team, because they need it, for one. Everyone in any nonprofit organization has a role to play when it comes to philanthropy. I was at the Historic House Museum. It was everyone from someone driving someone from the parking lot to the manor house for a tour, the receptionist picking up the phone and being kind to everyone, because you don't know who the million-dollar donor does not normally announce themselves on the phone. You're just picking up the phone and saying hello. Those little things make a difference, and making sure that the entire staff and organization understands what kind of impact that can have. Everyone has a role to play when it comes to philanthropy, and the more that everyone understands that capacity for impact, the better culture of philanthropy you have in your organization, the more people want to be giving to your organization.
The soundbite we should walk away with today: everyone within your organization, no matter your title, no matter your role, has a integral part when it comes to philanthropy. And I want you to remember that. You could be working in a museum and could be that docent. You could be that person at the front desk. You could be working in the gift shop. You could be the person that is janitorial staff. You all make a difference in the philanthropic success of your organization. Dan, thanks again. Really appreciate it. Look forward to the next time when we're together.
Thank you again for having me.
Bye, folks. Catch you next time on Impactability and Nonprofit Leaders Podcast. I'm your host, Josh. It's time for another edition of Coach's Corner. This is where we put our impact coaches to the test and ask the questions that you sent us to give them. They've got 5 minutes to answer it. These questions are great, so thank you for sending them in. If you haven't sent one, please by all means send us a question. Doesn't matter what it is. Our address is impactcoaches@impactability.net. Today's question is, how can we effectively measure the social impact of our nonprofit's work? Kim, you have 5 minutes to answer the question, and your 5 minutes begins now.
Hi, I'm Kim Hales, the Director of Client Services at SoupUp Strategic Solutions, and I want to talk today about one of my favorite topics, and that is measuring the social impact of your organization. And it's one of the things that I think really challenges many nonprofits, but is also something that can really move you forward and be able to tell your story to not only grant funders, which is, I think, where a lot of organizations really focus on that data because there's an expectation of providing these metrics, but donors now, in the change in the way they're looking and expecting information, they really want more of that definition and quantifying how you're creating change. They want to see where the impact of their funds are going. And I think looking at that from that perspective, and not only the grant funding, in looking at how you can share that information with donors is really important. It's also really important for organizations to have this information because they can use it internally to understand and have the ability to know where to invest more time, more resources, more money, and to be able to do better over time. I know for many, it seems like a challenging and daunting task. I think a lot of organizations certainly run with small staffs and they have a lack of resources. And some really complex issues are hard to measure in that data. But it's really important for organizations to really figure out and dig deep into how they can take what they're doing and really quantify and measure what those outcomes are. One of the ways you can start looking at that, and a really important way to look at it, is to create SMART objectives. And when you look at that, you're looking at specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time-bound objectives. So that's an acronym, SMART. And it's really allowing you to focus and be very specific about what you're looking at. Once you have some of those SMART objectives, you want to look at the difference between outcomes and outputs. So many people who have done a logic model or have been requested that from a funder will know and see this, but there are a lot of people who don't really quite understand the difference between those two. So an output is what you're doing. So you are teaching 10 financial literacy classes. You have served 400 meals to the hungry. You have 12 beds in a shelter. Those are your outputs, the numbers of activities that you're doing. But what comes from that are your outcomes. So the outcome of serving 400 meals is that those families have had a healthy, safe place to be, a place to eat, and have nutrition that they might not have gotten otherwise. When you teach 10 financial literacy classes, you're giving people the tools that they need to be more productive and apply for a loan, to fix their credit, to be able to get into a rental situation for a home, looking at what the outcomes of the activities that you're doing. And another really important part of that is really to be transparent when you're talking about how you're sharing the data, what your methodologies are, what limitations you have, right? Be honest with donors about what those metrics really are. Another thing that you got to look at is that it's not a one-dimensional concept. These are human beings for the most part, animals or whatever kind of organization you're working with, but those are really interesting stories. So we've got to take some of that data and transition into narratives and visual representations of what the change is. Not everybody wants a 10-page data-driven report. Some donors, some funders are going to want to see one page, a visual representation of that impact. And so being able to really have both of those kinds of tools in your tool belt to share with people is going to be really important. Again, these are not easy concepts. It's not a one size fits all to measure that social impact, but the importance of being effective in it, especially as we transition to a new type of donor, younger donors, and the changes in corporate philanthropy and what their focus is, it's really important to be able to have that data available to be able to share with donors, to be able to really move your missions forward, to increase that giving, and to be able to fulfill the missions that you are working really hard to make change in your communities.
Kim, thanks for joining us again on Coach's Corner and sharing your knowledge and expertise on how we can effectively measure the social impact of our nonprofit's work. Thanks for joining us today. Be sure to sign up for our newsletter at impactability.live. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app. That way you'll get new episodes downloaded as soon as they come out. Also, please give us a review or a rating so that your peers in the nonprofit industry can find us as well. I'm Josh Hirsch. Thanks for listening, and thank you for all you do to make the world a better place through your nonprofit.